This is 4:55 on Monday, October 10th. Good morning. Wow.
Still awfully short.
Awfully short.
Extra credit.
Sign in, folks. No folks questions today. We will have flex questions on Wednesday.
Is there a large withdrawal from the class?
I have not noticed that, but it's possible. I don't know. I like it that people are sitting up close. That's nice. Thank you. Appreciate that. So just a quick review of logistics. The project is due this evening. The exam one take-home recovery points thingy is due in class on Wednesday. So, and I'll collect those then. I got quite a few questions over the weekend from people with issues about the assignment. Hopefully I addressed whatever it was that was, I tried to thoroughly address the questions. But are there other questions and problems at this point? Yeah, Matt.
So I just had a question on motions.
What are the last
two
functions?
Well, the last two functions for me are the byte at a time, kilobyte at a
time. Uh-huh.
So when you're sending and receiving one byte at a time, I mean, mine is just a loop to go through how many times your system can send and receive,
right.
Correct?
Uh-huh.
But they're both out of sync. Like, one will finish the amount of sends before the other one receives the amount of bytes that it's supposed to receive. And so, I mean, I'm not sure how to exactly sync them because everything's connected correctly, and the other functions confirm that the information is being sent.
Uh huh.
So I'm not sure how to, I guess, address the answer. Am I supposed to like send a much larger packet than just one byte?
No.
Okay.
No. When sending, so remember, TCP is a reliable byte stream protocol. Everything you send, and only what you send, is what's received by the receiver. So if you are sending 500,000 bytes, one byte at a time, the receiver should get 500,000 bytes. Okay?
Even if there's like some still going on the wire?
Well, there can't... You know, the receiver is supposed to receive, having read the number, right, there's a number at the beginning, right, that tells the receiver how many bytes it's supposed to receive, right? So it should receive that many bytes, and when it has received that many bytes, then it should produce the response. Okay? Somebody else was having a problem around this, too. So I'm not... I'm not shocked by the fact that you're having an issue, but I don't know what it could be, because if you actually send 500,000 bytes and the receiver receives 500,000, then the receiver must receive 500,000 bytes, or TCP is not working, and we know TCP is working. So, the only thing I can think of is that perhaps. Somehow you're losing count of how many bytes have been received in the process, or how many have been sent. I don't know what it could be without looking at code, but that's the only thing I can think of that would cause you to reach a point where you've sent 500,000 bytes from the sender and the receiver is still waiting. Right? The receiver should not. There will be a certain amount of time. Right, between when you send the last byte and the receiver gets it, but it shouldn't be an outstanding amount of time.
Okay.
Right. Okay. That's the best I can do. Yeah.
So I verified that the server is getting the correct amount of bytes, but when I write to a file, when I write the good and bad end, like just by itself.
Uh-huh.
On the server, I verified that it's 4 bytes for both of those, but then when it writes to the file will be like 11 bytes or 8 bytes big. I don't know if you had that issue. Or
should not be.
I literally just did good int and bad int and then of it on the server, printed it out, and it's 4 bytes. And then when it, I've only printed that to the file,
uh-huh.
The file size is 8 bytes.
Well,
bytes.
Okay. Well, what you're supposed to be writing to the file is exactly what you receive.
Yeah.
Okay. So are you sending a 1 byte command, or are you sending something other than
I'm
a 1 byte?
I'm sending a 1 byte command, but I wasn't even printing that out because I was just verifying because the file size is like 10 bytes bigger than what it should be, and I was just trying to find out where that problem was happening.
Okay. Well, look inside the file and see what.
I did, and the number has been printed out exactly.
It's only because of integers.
Are you converting the integer to characters?
No.
Before you write it to the file?
I've printed percent D.
Yeah, okay, you're converting it to characters.
Okay.
Write exactly what you received. Just take those bytes and write them into the file with a write.
Okay?
Yeah, if you convert them to characters, it's going to be different.
Okay.
Yeah. Colin.
Well,
that was your point.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay. Just take exactly what... I'm saying this not for you because I know you've got it, but I'm saying this for the rest of the class. When you get a buffer full of bytes, just say write that buffer that size into the log file. Yeah.
Is there like a more correct way of converting them to bytes? Because I'm just taking a character pointer and then advancing it, and I thought that would do it, but I wasn't sure.
That should do it.
Okay.
You shouldn't have to convert anything, right?
Yeah. I was doing some bit manipulation, but then I'm not very strong with that, so I just decided to make a character pointer. But then it would give me just a weird value, like /x97, and I was like, whoa.
So what? Go look up what that means.
All right.
Yeah. Right. When you're sending it in the client server protocol, you're just sending the 4 bytes. Okay. When you print it, let me think. In the client to server protocol, you're sending it as 4 bytes. In the response from the server, the server is making a string. Right. So then it's converted to characters. I missed that last little bit.
So for when you write it to the file, you write the 4 bytes you receive, not the string version of the number?
Correct.
Yeah.
Everything you write into the file should be exactly what you receive, without any conversion. Others? Right.
Questions about any problems on redoing the exam? I know everybody's focused on doing the project, probably haven't got to the exam yet, but again, if you do have questions, feel free to email me. The exam thing is supposed to be, you know, just you and me discussion, not with your colleagues. Understand. Okay,
so we were talking about about IP datagrams, what was in the IP datagram header. I believe that we finished talking last time about time to live and talked about how it's just a count of how many hops the packet has taken, and it's a limit on the number of hops the packet can take. Every time it takes a hop, passes through a router, that number is decreased by 1. If it ever gets to 0, the packet is discarded. Right? So that's the notion of time to live. The other thing that's a little tricky in the IP version 4 header is this idea of fragmentation, which we're going to talk about on the next slide. And that's what this whole second row is about. There's a 16-bit packet identifier, and then there are some flags and offsets and things. So let's take
take a look at what that's all about. So let's go into presentation mode for doing that. Did all that. Okay, so here's the issue. IP packets can be up to 64 kilobytes in length, right? The packet header contains a 16-bit length field. Is it length field? All right. Yes, 16-bit length field. which translates to 64 kilobytes. Link layer implementations like Ethernet, serial point-to-point protocol over serial links, Wi-Fi networks, all of those typically have a much smaller maximum packet size, which is called the maximum transfer unit. Okay? And so for Ethernet, that number is about 1,500. For Wi-Fi networks, it also may be 1,500 or so. And the question is, suppose a router now has got a 64 kilobyte packet, and it's trying to stuff it over this layer that doesn't support 64 kilobyte packets. What is it supposed to do? And that's where this idea of fragmentation comes into play. So here's our nice big packet with its, the dark blue is the IP header on the front of it. Graphical language. Nice big packet arrives. Won't fit over this link, so this router does what is called fragmentation. It takes this one and divides it up into smaller pieces. Once it has been divided into smaller pieces, fragments, those fragments don't ever get put back together again until they reach the final destination. Okay, which then puts them together in a process called reassembly and squirts them out to the upper layer. Okay?
So in terms of receive, would the computer basically wait until it has the entire packet and then receive the entire thing?
Right. So that's what this is showing, that at the network layer in this receiving computer, those fragments get put back together before they get delivered up to the transport layer. Okay? And those that second row of stuff in the header is we need to implement that. So, here's our example. This is that second row of the header. Notice that this is not the second row. This is the length field, which is in the first row of the header. Then comes this ID field, a fragmentation flag, and an offset. And this is what it looks like. This is the big long one arriving at the router. We want to stick it out over a link that has a maximum MTU of 1,500 bytes. So here's what happens. We turn this one IP datagram into three datagrams. And each of them, except for the fragmentation stuff, looks like an ordinary IP datagram. It says how long it is, and it's got a checksum over its header and all that stuff. It's got the same source and destination addresses we had before, but now we have in it an ID field copied from the original one, and that's just a small number that's used by the host to identify this packet. But now the fragmentation flag is turned on. Okay? And the offset field amongst those fragmentation fields becomes significant. This says the offset of this fragment that we're looking at right here is 0.
then the next one says, because the MTU is 1500, its length is also 1500, it has the same ID field, it's also a fragment, and the offset is 185. Why 185? Well, the offset field is actually expressed in multiples of 8. So if you multiply 8 times 185, what do you get?
1500.
About 1500, not quite 1500. Let's see what we actually get. 800 plus 640 is 1440 plus 8 times 4. So 1680. So why 1680 and not 1500? How big is an IP header? And that accounts for the difference, right? Because although we started out with 4,000. Of that, 3980 was actually data, and the other was 20 bytes of IP header. Now we have another IP header in here. So the data piece here is, the data here is only 1480 bytes, plus the 20 of the header makes the 1500. Then we have 1480 more in this one. App offset 1480 in the data. And then we have the final fragment. It's got the same ID. The flag, the fragmentation flag, is now zero, but the offset is non-zero, and that tells the receiver that this is the final fragment of an original packet, right? It says no more fragments are coming. One way to think of this fragmentation flag is as meaning there are more fragments to come. If it's zero, there aren't. And if it's one, there are. And the offset tells you where it belongs within them. Okay. So, just another way of thinking about the fact that the header length matters here is if you look at the sum of these three numbers, what do you get? The sum of these three lengths. 40, right? We started out with 4,000. Where did the extra 40 bytes come from? Well, there'd be two more headers that we didn't have before. Okay. Okay.
Can you go back?
Yep, I sure can.
I heard 16 something instead of 1480 for the bytes. Right?
What do you mean you heard?
Earlier, I thought somebody said 1600 or something, but we got out of it. 1640 or 16.
No, no. If you multiply 185 by 8, you get 800 plus 640 is 1440. Plus 40 is 14. So that's where you heard the 6 come in.
Right.
It was 6, not 16. Okay? Absolutely ask questions like that. We don't need confusion around those, and questions are great to clarify. All right, let's talk about now the addressing of IP version 4 packets. So next time we will have clicks questions about addressing. Addressing lends itself to clicks questions in a way that most of the stuff I've talked to up to now doesn't. Oh, and as does fragmentation. So we'll have some clicks questions about fragmentation as well. Okay, so an IP version 4 address is a 32-bit number, right? And it identifies a host or router's
interface. Not the host or the router, but a particular interface on a host or router. A host or routers naturally have many interfaces, because that's their job, is to connect to multiple link layer things and move packets between them, so they have to have many interfaces. Hosts can have multiple interfaces, and actually we're all pretty used to that now, because our laptops typically do. They have an Ethernet. Well, they used to have an Ethernet, and they had a Wi-Fi. Oh, and they have a Bluetooth, which might be used for IP. So many interfaces can be present on a host, and you can have multiple Ethernets, you know, whatever. So each of those has an IP address, and it is a 32-bit number. Now, for some reason, and I think I mentioned this before, way back in the dark ages of the internet, people decided that the way we were going to write these addresses down, when we write them for human consumption, is we were going to convert each of the 4 bytes of the 4-byte address to a decimal number and put a dot between them. So that's why you see 223.1.1.3 here, because we've converted those bytes to decimal numbers and put dots between them. Just as a side point, which is not on the slide, whenever we're sending these 4-byte numbers, we send them in network byte order. In other words, the high order byte is the first one that goes in the buffer. It has the low address in the buffer. So whenever you have one of these, and you've seen this in the programming that you're doing, right? When you put an IP address into the bind or connect call, you use H to NL on it in order to put it into network byte order. Okay, so we're not going to do that. Fine. All right. So, we talked before about the forwarding tables in routers, and we talked about how it just would not do to have an entry in a forwarding table for every possible host on the internet, right? Because there are roughly 4 billion addresses, and that would require forwarding tables with 16 gigabytes of memory or something in order to implement. So we don't do that. Instead, the way the internet is organized is into what are called subnets. And that sort of is suggested by the name internet, right? Inter means between, and the thing that the internet is between is its subnets. So we divide up the world into these subnets, and different subnets have different addresses, and then within a subnet, the hosts have different addresses. And the idea is that the routers can only worry about the subnet addresses and not have to worry about the host addresses. And in fact, we take this through multiple levels and try to make the routing tables even smaller by organizing the subnet sensibly. But sort of at the edges, here in this room, when you're talking to the WSU wireless, you're on a particular subnet, and your host has a particular address within that subnet. Now, how does that work? Before I go on from there, here's a useful practical definition for what constitutes a subnet. Right. All of the hosts on a subnet can reach each other without going through a router.
That's a very practical definition of what is a subnet. And if you keep that in mind, I think everything else will be much easier to understand. So, so this doesn't show this very well. So let me try this. See if I can do this. That didn't do too much. Don't want to point. I just don't get. What is supposed to happen here? It looks like I have a little point, a little penny thing here, and I select that. Aha. I don't know why it took so long. So, got to get the right slide. So we've got 4 bytes, 8 bits each, that make up an IP address. And we've said we've divided the world into subnets and hosts. And part of this 4 bytes will be called the subnet address, and it will always be some prefix set of bytes, and the rest of the bytes will be called, the rest of the bits will be called the host part. Clear enough? So, some prefix of the IP address is called the subnet part, the rest is called the host part. And the way we write that distinction is that we write the number of bits in the subnet part after a slash. So, we say that this is the 223.1.1.0, we use for the subnet part, we zero out the host bits, /24 subnet. Okay? That's one way we do it. The boundary can be anywhere. You can have /8 subnets, you can have /23 subnets. I guess I lied a little bit. I don't think you can have anything smaller than, bigger than /30. Yeah, I think /30 is the biggest number that could be there. The reason being that the lowest address and the highest address on a subnet are reserved, and so if you had 31, then there could only be 2 addresses and they would both be reserved and there would be no space left for an actual host. Okay, so /30 is the biggest number that would be there. That's one way we write these things. But now, if you've got your computer open, don't open it if you don't have it open, because we can look at mine instead. There's another way that we identified the subnet part,
the host part, and that's using what's called a subnet mask. Okay? So, if you do this ipconfig, or what is it on Linux systems, ifconfig, ifconfig, ipconfig, you will see the subnet part expressed typically as one of these subnet masks, which looks like one of these dotted decimal addresses in which all of the bits at the beginning are 1 and then the rest of the bits are 0. So here's a good exercise, and we'll do this with some Qlix questions next time. Slash notation corresponds to this netmask. So how can we figure that out? Well, we know that it's no bigger than 24. It's got to be smaller than 24 because all the bits of the last byte are 0. So that means we're somewhere in the middle of the third byte. How many bits of this are 0 at the right end? Well, what's the difference between this and the maximum number could be? 50, right? And so 15 is represented by 4 bits, and so this is actually a slash 20 network. This is the this is a slash 20 network, meaning 20 bits of subnet, and how many bits of host? 12, right? The difference between 20 and 32. 20 are subnet, the rest are host. Okay. Now this is a harder one. So what is the actual subnet address of this network? Quite a lot harder, actually. I'm not sure that we could do it in our head. I'll attempt it, but we'll see. So, certainly, well, in the subnet, the last byte is going to be all 0, right? We zero out in the subnet address, we zero out all the places that are 0 in the net mask. So that's 0. Now, how about this one? The last 4 bits have to be 0. And so what is 174 in hex? It's AE, I think. Right? Because A is 10 times 16 is 160, and E is 14 added to that. So it's AE. Okay? And so E is like F, except it doesn't have the. Oh yeah. What are we doing? We're turning off 4 bits, right? Yeah, we're turning off the last 4 bits. So this will be 172.19.160.0. Will be the subnet address. Okay?
Well, it's after you turn off the last 4 bits.
After you turn off these 8 bits, and you turn off the last 4 bits of this one, and you're left with 160. That's how it works. What's 160?
We figured out it was using binary.
Oh, doing it using binary, right? After you practice doing it binary, you may want to practice doing it using hex, because that cuts down how many thinking operations you have to do by a factor of 4. I'm lazy. If we could chuck things together, we could go faster. All right. So, other useful information from this
from this for IP version 4 is the default gateway. So if my laptop has a packet it wants to send to somebody that's not on the same subnet, it's going to have to use the router or the gateway. And so it needs to have a address that's on the same subnet in order to do that. And that will be the address of the gateway. And let's confirm that this address is in fact on the same subnet. Well, it's 172.19.160 plus 15, right? FF in the last. F. 160.15 is F. Okay, so that's F, and 254 is hex FE. So this is this gateway's address is indeed on the same subnet, and it is the highest usable address on the network. And that's a convention that network administrators often adopt, is to make the gateway or router have the highest addresses on the network. There's one more address higher, 175.255. That's the broadcast address on that network. And that's why it's special, right? That's why it's reserved. It says, when I send to that address, I want all of the machines on the network to receive it. Okay? Questions about this? It's pretty simple in concept, and you just need to learn sort of the manipulations that go with it to carry it out.
So I noticed that the IPv6 has a percent sign in there.
Oh, well, we're not talking about IPv6.
Okay.
Thank goodness. Yeah, it has a percent sign. Oh, look at that. Yeah, so it does. Interesting.
So that's not a hexadecimal.
That's not hexadecimal. It's hex everywhere else except for that percent. Here, this one has a percent in it as well.
Mine does too, except in a different position.
In a different position. Okay. Well, we're going to have to investigate that when we talk about IP version 6. That's one of the things I want to do this year. The book does not cover IP version 6 very well. And so when we get to talking about IPv6, probably on Friday, I want to go into that a little bit more, because IPv6 is a coming thing. As I've said before, it's been coming for 20 years, but it is coming. We're starting to see it present by default in things now, so maybe we'll get there. And notice that the IP version 6 addresses use a completely different convention for how you write them down. They're 128 bits long, which makes them a lot harder to write. But they're also somewhat more organized. They're organized into different pieces of the namespace. So. All right. Enough of that. Okay, so you can look at this. You can look at this. I forgot. One other question about that previous one, about what we were looking at on my IP config screen. We said that this wireless network is a /20 subnet, right? Means that there are 12 bits of host address. How many hosts is that? How many hosts are possible on that subnet? 12 bits worth. Okay? Let's see if we can turn that into an actual number. So it's actually pretty easy. If you remember a few key things. Here's the trick. 2 to the 10th
is about 1,000. 2 to the 20th is about 1 million. Okay? And for the 1,000 case, it's easy to remember the about factor, right? It's about 1,000. What's the power of 2 that's closest to 1,000? 1024, right? Boom, boom. All right? So, 2 to the 10th is 1,024. And we're talking about 2 to the 12th. How much bigger than 2 to the 10th is that?
What do we multiply by?
4.
Yeah.
4, right? Because 2 bits represents 4, up to 4. So 4 times 1024 is 4096. Okay? So our first guess, 4096. How many hosts does it support? But remember I said there are two special addresses. The highest one is the broadcast address, and the lowest one is used when it's also kind of a broadcast address. It's sort of used that way. It's not formally called that. It's called the unknown host, but sort of acts like broadcast. Anyway, the highest and lowest are special. So, how many hosts does this subnet support? 4094.
See? Lots of good Clex questions lurking in things like that.
So this picture is just showing us that subnets are things that you can get to without going to routers. So this notation with the slashes is called classless interdomain routing. We achieved a classless society on the internet around 1996 or so. Before that, people had thought that IP addresses ought to be divided up into class A, class B, class C, class D, which corresponded to fixed size subnets of. Can you imagine a subnet with 8 bits of subnet address and all the rest for hosts? How many hosts does that support, approximately?
153.
What? Well, if I take away 8 bits, I'm left with 24 bits. Right? Okay? How many hosts are possible with 24 bits? Let's not get too precise about this. 4 times a million. No, 16 times a million. 4 bits, which represents up to 16 times a million. Okay? So, 16 million hosts on your subnet. Not very practical, actually. Right? But those were defined, and B was 2 bytes worth, and C was 3 bytes worth, and D was 4 bytes worth. Anyway, that classful approach to divvying up the space went by the wayside when people realized it was just not practical, and we started doing the so-called classless version, where we just pick a number that's practical for our network and design things around that.
Oh, and it's pronounced cider, for what it's worth. Okay, so how does a host get its IP address?
So there are a number of different ways that you can do this. The old-fashioned way, and the way that's typically used on servers, is to hard code it into a system configuration file. So the system administrator, when setting up the host, will write down in a system configuration file, you're supposed to have this IP address and this net mask, and here's your default gateway, and here's your host name. Yeah.
at least those things, right? So this is really impractical, right, for any situation where you have students wandering around a university using a Wi-Fi network, using different Wi-Fi networks. It would be really kind of awful if every time you moved from one classroom to another classroom, you had to get a new IP address by and write it into your configuration file. So instead, the world has switched largely to what's called dynamic host configuration protocol, which is a way for a computer to ask what IP address, what subnet, what host name it ought to be using. And we'll go through how that works here momentarily. I think Andrew would tell me that my statement earlier about servers being configured with static configuration is not the way it's done either anymore. When DHCP was still coming into existence, that's what people still did because they didn't trust DHCP. But instead, what we do these days is we configure the servers, which are really supposed to have addresses that don't ever change. We just configure the DHCP server to do that, to assign the same address all the time to particular machines and not reassign those addresses to other things. Everybody pretty much uses DHCP to get their IP addresses now, because otherwise it means going around to all those machines and laying your hands on them, whereas when you're doing it with DHCP, it's merely a matter of editing a single file that controls the whole network. Single file or database, actually. We use, for EECS, we use a database that contains all this information, and the DHCP server refers to that database. Okay, so how does it work? So here we have this host. It has newly arrived on the network. And it uses the broadcast facility of the network. And the default broadcast address, which is all zeros, sorry, all ones. Default IP broadcast address is all ones. Independent of what subnet you're on, you can broadcast with the all ones IP address, and some host on the network will say, I'm the DHCP server, this is a DHCP discover message, I'm the one who's supposed to handle that, and it will respond with an offer that contains information about what IP address to use. The host then requests that, and the server confirms it with a DHCP ACK. Now, one thing that I have been meaning to look up and keep forgetting to do is, why do we go through this process of being offered an address and then requesting it and then ACKing it instead of just saying, okay, you told me what I should use. Let's do that. And I think the answer is that before requesting an address, the host actually confirms that nobody else is using it. And the host confirms that nobody else is using it. And you may have seen this on your particularly Windows machines from time to time, that you'll get a little pop-up that says, somebody else on this network is using my address. Right? That's a very bad thing. Somebody else on the network is using your address. It's a bad thing. And why do we do that from the host that's requesting the address and not from the server? So there's another little complication in this protocol, which says that the DHCP server itself need not be on the same network. There can be what's called a relay that captures this discover message and passes it off to some other network, to a host on some other network, which is actually running the DHCP server.
And so it has a particular viewpoint of what addresses have been assigned and which haven't, but it has no way to test that because it's on a different network. So I think that's why we go through this process of doing a discover and offer. Then we test whether it's okay to use that address. If it is, we request it, and then we get confirmation that we're allowed to use it. Okay? So that, thank you for suffering through as I thought that through, because I didn't remember what that issue was, but now I think I do. Okay, so sorry. I need an address. This illustrates how that goes. That's what a discover message looks like. We get back. Oh, this is another example of a protocol that uses leases. You guys are actually very patient today. It's well past the hour. You're letting me go on, and usually by now somebody's getting up. So thank you very much for your patience, and I'll see you on Wednesday. We'll have some questions about all of this on CLICS. Thank you.